Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call to order this March 23rd, 2015 meeting of the Senate Committee on Workforce. We have two major items of business today. First, we want to at last complete our public hearings on Senate Bills 598 and 809, those having to do with apprenticeship. And then we will move into a work session on Senate Bill 454, that is the earned sick leave bill. And the work session will be for the purpose of going through and explaining the Dash 3 amendments. Okay. So with that, I'm going to open concurrent public hearings on Senate Bill 598 and Senate Bill 809. And I'd like to call up Daryl Fuller and Ryan Tribbett and Brian Krieg, please. Is Ryan here? Thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller here this morning on behalf of the Oregon State Association of Plumbing and Heating and Cooling Contractors. Nothing brings joy to the heart of a lobbyist like knowing you're going to testify against a bill introduced by the chair of the committee, especially when you like it so much that you came down here and testified in favor of it a couple of weeks ago. So I appreciate this opportunity. I'm going to begin with 809 so I can finish off on 598 on a little bit of a better note. When the chair testified in favor of Senate Bill 809, when it was first heard, you couched it in terms of a carrot that you were offering to the contracting community to give them an opportunity to bid on state contractors. I had a meeting with just under 40 members of our association last week for a dinner, and we talked about this bill. And I can tell you that outside of the four walls of the Capitol, the regulated community doesn't see this bill as a carrot, but rather as a stick, and a rather substantial stick at that, in that if you don't meet a specific criteria, you're prohibited from bidding on state contracts for an entire year. And that's a fairly substantial stick as opposed to a carrot. So because of that, our association is opposed to Senate Bill 809. Understanding that, there are some specific concerns we have with the way the bill's drafted, and so I'd like to just point out some things that concern us. If any of them have resonate with you at all, then perhaps there can be some modifications to the resulting bill, although to be fair, if those changes were made, we probably still would oppose the bill in its final condition. First is the bill sets a standard of 10%, but does allow the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to go above 10%. Nobody's done these kind of surveys of the amount of actual apprenticeship work that is being done. So one of our first concerns is when everybody turns in all of this information the first time, what do we do if in one of the areas there isn't a 10% standard that's reached? What if we have an industry that isn't there yet? Does that mean that nobody can bid on a contract for a whole year because there isn't 10% in a particular industry? We're also concerned with the notion of geographic diversity. What would happen in the circumstance where only in the Portland area were there qualified bidders for contracts around the state, where perhaps in other regions, whether it's in Southern Oregon or Central Oregon, the contractors were at 9.5%, but they're precluded from being able to submit a bid for an entire year, and therefore all the work has to come out of the city of Portland. I think my clients would be fairly frustrated with me to suggest that we give more authority to the labor commissioner rather than less. But I believe if you're going to give the labor commissioner the authority to go above 10%, maybe you ought to give him the authority to go below 10%, depending on what market reality is, and especially in the initial stages. I believe it was your testimony and perhaps the testimony of others that you think the standards, that once the survey is done, that it's going to be above 10% and perhaps substantially above it. But we believe that the possibility now or in the future could exist that it would be below 10%. Second concern that we have is the January 31 deadline of every year. So January 31st of every year, apprenticeship programs are required to turn in all the information for all of their trainers for the previous year. And I sat with legislative counsel and asked him this question, and I appreciate his time, but I said, so what happens if a JATC does not get the information in by January 31st? Does that mean that all of their trainers they're cannot bid for an entire year? He says, well, no, the deadline's there, but it doesn't have any impact. They would still be able to submit information late. Well, I would like to see that in writing someplace, that if the January 31 deadline has a purpose, we'd like to know what the purpose is. And if you can turn things in after January 31 and still qualify to bid, that's not listed anywhere in the bill. So we're concerned at what would happen if a JATC were to turn in the information after January 31st. This requires all the JATCs to collect the information from their training agents and to submit it to BOLI, and that is the information that BOLI would use to determine the 10%. The individual contractors don't do that directly. We run one apprenticeship program. We have one part-time employee that does that for us. And there may be some other smaller apprenticeship programs around the state. We would like to have an opt-out, frankly. If an apprenticeship program doesn't think that they have the staffing or the level of staffing necessary to collect and submit that kind of information, we think there ought to be a process that would allow them to opt out and have the training agents submit their information directly. And I was also asked the question, if somebody wants to be a training agent in a JATC, but they're worried that having that person join the JATC would take the collective percentage below 10%, and therefore you have a group of people that were already below 10%, but were using the collective 10% to do bidding, to bring in another contractor would put them below and therefore would preclude them from bidding. Would we have circumstances where a JATC would refuse to let somebody come in as a new training agent because of their experience would have a negative impact on the overall percentage of that JATC? So those are the initial concerns we have over Senate Bill 809. Did you want the others to talk about Senate Bill 809 and then come back to 598?
No, you might as well go ahead and do it, okay. Daryl.
And then again, Daryl Fuller for the Oregon Plumbing, Heating, Cooling Contractors in favor here on behalf of them for Senate Bill 598. This is one that we actually like most of, Senate Bill 598. Do have a couple of questions. One, there's nothing in the task force that talks about size or geographic diversity, and we think that there would be some advantage to putting some sort of diversity in there when it comes to the size of the business or the geographic representation of the businesses. And then on the first page, lines 27 and 28, it has four members who are representatives of labor organizations or other representatives of persons who are engaged in apprenticeable occupations. It seems to us that that would permit there to be just four labor representatives for all four of those slots, rather than having some that are open shop and closed shop, because it says four members who are representatives of. It gives another option, but would allow all four of them to be labor organizations. And we're not sure how the language persons who are engaged in apprenticeable occupations would seem to preclude associations like mine that does run an apprenticeship program. It would seem to be, maybe it would be one of my board members, but there's some advantage, I would think, perhaps to having somebody on the committee that is actually a manager of a JATC that's a non-union JATC, somebody who actually does the paperwork rather than somebody who's perhaps just sitting on the committee itself. So by and large, we like the idea of apprenticeship task forces and looking at ways that we can expand apprenticeship programs. We just like to see perhaps some more statutory diversity in who makes up that committee. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you, Daryl. And we'll wait till we hear from the other two gentlemen. I just want to say I appreciate your candor and your suggestions. I think if the two people who follow want to address any of them, that would be great. But I think that they're all worth considering. Thank you.
For the record, Ryan Tribbett with PacWest here on behalf of the National Electrical Contractors Association. We participated in the working group process the Apprenticeship Utilization Task Force, and we're sort of concerned with some of the direction that initially it was taking. One of the early meetings, we had presentations from Washington State and also ODOT explaining their programs. They had programs that were project-specific requirements, utilization requirements on just public projects, and they're structured a little differently. Some had incentives and disincentives. Some were focused on the general contract. There was conversation about whether we should have it at the subcontract level, whether it should apply at certain dollar thresholds or certain man-hour thresholds, and there was a really big concern with all those things being debated that every public contracting agency was going to adopt different standards and become sort of a compliance nightmare for contractors that are trying to do the right thing. So sort of one mechanism or instrument to sort of enshrine certain accountability measures and things in statute has been through the responsible contractor laws. It's where we got the requirement to be licensed, bonded, insured, have workers' compensation coverage, make sure that you're compliant on taxes. All those sorts of things exist in responsible contractors. So, and it's consistent across all agencies that where you're bidding. And so we thought that that way made a lot more sense for businesses in terms of their ability to comply. And so NECA suggested the responsible contractor mechanism. I think it was in the fourth meeting out of seven. So it was debated, yeah, at the fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh. So more than half of the meetings were debating, at least in part, the responsible contractor policy. We think it's sound, and we'd like your support for it.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, I'm Brian Krieg, here representing the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association, IBEW, Local 16 Sheet Metal, and the UA 290 Plumbers. Now that I've gotten through that list, looking at Senate Bill 809, I agree with the things that Mr. Tribbett has said. Contracting and apprenticeship is a very complex issue, and for every type of contractor and a specific model, there's dozens of other derivations of that. So that trying to come up with a solution, the task force looked at many, many different things, ran them up the flagpole. The problem is usually it wouldn't work for several types of groups and situations on it. Our contractors in my union, JATCs in particular, spend significant time and research resources researching and projecting workforce needs and trying to balance that against the projections for future work. And that's one of the essential issues with apprenticeship is you're wanting to make sure you're trying to balance it so that there's going to be jobs for the... Sorry. The essential, it's essential we balance workforce and the jobs on it. And I don't think there's any other industry really in the state that is as closely tied to education as our industries in construction are. Certainly not programs, most of them with the OUS system. I mean, realistically, we really hone down on getting the people. So in looking at, after going through the task force, we looked at 809 and the concepts within there and thought that this would probably be a doable approach and could move the ball forward without being a huge admin burden, because we already, if you're in a JATC, you're already presenting reports once a month that have the weeks and the hours and the information there. So it's something that, you know, contractors aren't going to have to create a whole other administrative monster to deal with. And I think that was very important. The dual approach of letting a contractor comply individually or through the JATC gave some variables so that there would usually be a way that it could be done if they're trying to have a good and legitimate program. And in the end, it would push us to keep the apprentices on board over a length of time, get them through to a graduation out there. But at the core of it, for 809 or any look at this, we need jobs. We need an economy We need some certainty out there about the types of projects going forward. Right at the moment, we're having a ripple at the moment where we're actually sending a lot of people back to the halls right at the moment because the Intel site is winding down. And yet we don't have some of the other things that have been in the pipeline for a couple of years moving forward. You're going to have the Convention Center Hotel bill back on the Senate floor in a day or two to fix the technicality on that. We really encourage you to pass that bill because that's one of those types of jobs out there that help us keep moving. So then if I move to 598 on that, that's an expansion of the current task force, and I really like the titling of it, of the 21st Century Apprenticeship, and starting to look at a number of things that came up within the process we went through, where you're trying to better connect the employers to the CTE programs out there and figuring out how do we bridge some of these gulfs and creating true apprenticeship programs for everyone. And the discussion needs to be expanded to other fields out there, such as manufacturing, healthcare, and others, because a lot of them are going to need some pooled workers in the long run to make to be able to move ahead in their industries. And I think looking and talking and having people come into that committee and potentially expanding it later on it would be a great idea. So, and the last thing of this, the issues of transferability of training and skills, so that what we're doing in the high schools and on into whether it's community college or the apprenticeship programs that are run directly, the person getting those skills can go work in other places. They're not just tied to a specific area. And I'd say as it was co-chair of the CTE grant program, seen many, many grant proposals, some very good ones, but most of them still are a little weak on that area, and some of them totally miss the concept of doing something, just an internship out with one little tiny business that only has four employees, and there's no real career path there. That's not a program. We need to be working on that, and I think this task force was dealing with that a little bit, and CTE came up at every single meeting on it. It was a dominant theme. So with that, I will conclude my remarks.
Thank you, Brian, and thanks for all your work on CTE over the years. We will be, I think, having a public hearing on some of the funding bills related to CTE in a couple of weeks, colleagues. I will add, with respect to, Daryl mentioned some additions that probably should be made to the task force. I have received a request to add one or two people from the community college world to it, since one of the tasks is to improve the relationship between apprenticeship and the community colleges, and to try to use the community colleges to help extend apprenticeship to the more rural areas. It makes sense to me that we do that.
Mr. Chair, yes, I might, and I didn't mention this on 598, but on page 2 of the bill, line 8, it does specifically say improve relationships between community colleges and union apprenticeship programs. We're not sure why that's limited to only union apprenticeship programs as opposed to both open and closed apprenticeship programs.
I think there's a perception that there have been issues between those two worlds, and that's why. But I will say that I think that the charge to the committee is going to be somewhat expanded. There's a parallel bill over on the House side that includes some things that we're trying to look at ways to perhaps meld the two together. Good point. Any questions, colleagues, of these gentlemen?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you all. Okay, colleagues, with that, I will close the concurrent public hearings on 598 and 809. And I will open our work session on Senate Bill 454. And just to kind of bring us up to date on where we are with this bill, you'll remember that several weeks ago, almost a month ago, we had public hearings on this bill. We had invited testimony during our regular meeting, and then in the evening we had public testimony at great length, but it was quite interesting. And just to remind you, we did that jointly with the House, and we maintained our participation. The Senate remained throughout that entire hearing, and thank you again for that. Since then, the House Business and Labor Chair and I have had a number of one-on-one meetings with a number of parties, and we formed a work group that was included a number of representatives. Just for the record, I'll tell you that that work group included Vice Chair Thatcher and the House Vice Chair, Representative Kenemer. It included representatives from OBA and AOI and the Restaurant Association, and as well as Family Forward, SEIU, UFCW, Boley, of course, our esteemed drafter, Charlie Cheek, was there. And Charlie has put many, many hours into helping to draft this bill. And so we, the result of all that work is the Dash 3 amendments that are before you. And I wanted to walk you through the issues that are addressed in the Dash 3. I think it's the easiest way to do that. You have before you, colleagues and members of the audience, you will find on OLIS a document called Senator Michael Dembro Info Packet, Effect of Dash 3, that is what I want to use to go through. And it articulates the major issues that are addressed in the Dash 3s, the major elements of the program, followed by the reference to the section in the Dash 3, the relevant sections in the Dash 3 amendments. So I will go through these and answer any questions that you have, and then talk about next steps. So first of all, the bill does include a preemption on local governments enacting their own sick leave ordinances. So this bill, once approved, will be setting the stage consistently around the state. Employer size, it will cover employees in two ways. It's a paid benefit for employers who have six or more employees, and it's an unpaid benefit for employers with fewer than six employees. It's protected unpaid leave. That is, an employee can't be disciplined for requesting and under the right and being granted those that leave up to the 40 hours of the benefit, which is what you see in the next section. The annual benefit is for 40 hours. 40 hours is the most that can be used in a year. And let me say, of course, for all of these, that if an employer has a program that gives higher benefits than this, of course, they're free to do that. And we'll address further on in this document that more specifically. There is the possibility of a carryover from year to year. There's not a financial element to this. That is, workers can't be cashed out for unused sick leave unless an employer so chooses. But it is possible, if unused sick leave remains at the end of the year, to carry it forward to the next year. And the reason for that is there is a 90-day waiting period each year before you can use sick leave. You start accruing from day one. Actually, I'm not sure about that. The carryover will allow them to use, if they get sick at the beginning of the next year, within those 90 days. but they're still limited by that annual limit of 40 hours. The accrual rate is at least 1 hour leave for every 30 hours worked. Again, employers can, you know, have a faster accrual if they want, but it's got to be at least 1 hour for every 30 hours. Record keeping, you know, there was a concern that we heard among employers about having to keep records, and the initial bill had a requirement that they had to be kept for 3 years and then turned over to BOLI upon request. The bill, we've taken out, just to lighten the load, we've taken out all the specific requirements to keep records, but the employee does have a right to know how much they have in their bank, and so the employer can indicate that on their regular pay stub, as many employers currently do, or at least quarterly in some kind of communication. Shift trading, we anticipate that a lot of workers in the restaurant industry will prefer to trade shifts rather than use the benefit. This makes it clear that that is an ability that they have. The initial bill required that trade to happen within the same pay period, but we heard concerns about that could lead to developments that were detrimental both to the employee and to the employer, so we've removed that requirement. The minimum leave increment, we decided to leave this at the same standard as Oregon Family Leave Act, OFLA, which is 1 hour. Well, actually, we didn't. OFLA has it 1 hour or the smallest increment that the payroll system is set up to handle or something like that. But that latter seemed problematic, so we made it just 1 hour. We do have a clause that says that the employee will make reasonable attempt to take leave when it's least disruptive to business. So, and the thinking there, just to put this on the record, is, you know, whenever possible, the employee will take the leave at the beginning of their shift or the end of their shift, and not at the highest, the busiest time for the employer. Definition of employee, we're using the definition that is in ORS 652, and we've added a specific exclusion. This was at the request of one of the business associations for family members, independent contractors, and interns, and that made sense to us, so that is in there. Use of leave can be either for self-care or for care of a family member. And the family member is defined with the same definition as Oregon Family Leave Act. I will say that the initial bill included a more expansive definition of family, one that was, you know, someone with whom the employee had a relationship that was family-like, and that was, you know, in part, and we heard testimony about this, to deal with the changing nature of the family and how some, many individuals have relationships like that, but they're not actually family. They're not blood or through marriage. Speaking personally, someday I'd like to see us get to that standard, but I don't think we're there yet, and it just seemed for now, for the purposes of this bill, we should stick to the OFLA standard, so that's what that is. As I mentioned before, there's a 90-day waiting period, for those of you who saw the dash ones, we have moved this section where we talk about the 90-day waiting period from it was in its own section 5, and we've moved that now into Section 3. It just made sense to move it earlier because subsequently we talk about the 90-day period in other contexts, and it was confusing because we hadn't yet talked about the 90 days. So that's where you'll see some differences in page, in section numbering and page numbering between the dash ones and the dash threes, and that's what they're due to because we've moved the discussion of the waiting period earlier on. There is a break in service provision so that if an employer separates from the employee, if the employee separates from the employer for whatever reason, the accrual of any sort stops, including the accrual of the days to meet that 90-day threshold. It stops if the employee returns to that employer. They are able to resume their accrual as long as it happens within 180 days. Exemption, we have exempted some industries, employees in industries. This is primarily in the building trades area, where you'll have employees who they're not working for a single employer. They're working under a master collective bargaining agreement, where one day they might be working for this contractor, another week another contractor, and this deals with those situations, and it doesn't call them out by industry. It calls them out by the characteristics of their employment. And in that same part of the bill, you'll also see a discussion of home care workers, those who work, who are funded through the state as a result of an initiative that was passed a number of years ago. And they're working for a single family or giving care to a single individual, but they are employed. They have a relationship with the Home Care Commission, so this relates to their situation. This discusses their situation. Next, we have those businesses which have existing policies. Sick leave policies, including paid time off policies, and this new section clarifies, this section 4 clarifies that paid time off policies that meet or exceed the requirements in the bill and can be used for sick leave purposes have met the standard. And it also allows, so if many employers in their existing policies front-load the benefit so that at the beginning of each year an employee is eligible for X number of hours of leave. This makes it clear they don't have to worry about accrual. They have met the standard. And we have a note here, although you won't find this addressed specifically in the bill, but BOLI will be a resource to employers who are wondering, does my PTO, does that meet the standard or not? And we have a long, what we're referring to as a grace period, in which BOLI will be a resource to employers to answer their questions, to help them work their way through this system, through the new system. And if they have any questions about their policies, BOLI will help them with that. Medical verification can be required by employers for absences longer than 3 consecutive days, and if there is a suspected pattern of abuse, and the legislation describes what's meant by that, and if there if there are out-of-pocket costs for the employee beyond their what their insurance will cover, the employer will have responsibility for that. That's the way the system works under OFLA, and we're just extending that to this. Enforcement will be by BOLI along with private right of action, and any punitive action is limited to the retaliation piece of this. There's a grace period in the bill, as I mentioned before. That is, the law actually goes into effect January 1st, 2016, but BOLI will not assess penalties to employers who are found to not be meeting the terms for a year, again, just to help with the easing in period. Portland, in its ordinance, did that for the first 6 months of the ordinance. The state is bigger, so we're doubling that, so they'll have a year. There have been some issues raised about agricultural workers, and a couple of issues related to that. Most seasonal workers these days are actually employed not directly by the farmer, but by a labor contractor, and in fact the worker will be employed by the labor contractor. The labor contractor has the responsibility for the record keeping and the leave for the purposes of providing sick leave. Many seasonal workers on farms are actually paid on a piece rate basis, and they obviously have a lot of incentive to come to work and to do as much piecework as they can, you know, to get through that day. But we wanted to clarify that if and this is true actually for all workers, not just agricultural workers, that if they are working on a piece rate basis or a commission basis, that the sick leave, that they will be compensated at their regular rate of pay, which has to be at least the minimum wage. That's how the existing law is. And then finally, someone brought up the notion that there are a number of employers out there who want to give their employees the ability to donate their sick leave to fellow employees who really need it. In the initial form of this bill, that would have been precluded. We've made it clear that, you know, if the employer wants to have such a program, they can, and it meets the terms of this agreement. So that, in overview form, is what we have in the Dash 3 amendments. And colleagues, I'd be happy to answer any questions about them. Yes, Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the calculation of six employees, is that based on FTE or is that based on bodies?
It's based on bodies. And we're using the same calculation that OFLA uses as to determine what is that, you know, where is the cutoff between five and six.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Knope.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough. So we are using several OFLA items in this. Is there a reason we decided not to put the entire piece of paid sick leave under OFLA?
Well, you know, we did where it made sense, okay? And, you know, I mentioned already the 1 hour or, you know, smaller, you know, the smallest increment, which in many cases would be below an hour. That really, I don't know why that's in OFLA, but 1 hour seemed reasonable. So we made that change. We made the change in terms of the number of employees, for the employer size to align with the system in Portland. We have, just as background, we talked about this at the when we had our public hearing, there are two cities in Oregon that have adopted sick leave ordinances, Portland, which has a cutoff similar to this, and Eugene, which covers all workers. Employer size is not, is not relevant there. We made the decision that to make it any higher than the Portland standard would, take away a benefit that many, many, thousands of people are already enjoying, and that would be just very difficult to do. That's the rationale for the difference. Yes, Senator Rosenberg.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I wanted to just commend the work that's gone into this. I think that a lot of feedback has been incorporated into this amendment, which really replaces the original bill, I believe.
Does, yes.
And obviously, no one would be ever totally happy with this, but I think the co-chairs have incorporated a lot of what they've heard. I think that preemption was something that was important to employers, and so just happy to see this.
Thank you. Any other questions? No. Okay. Seeing none, in terms of, next steps, I'm going to carry over this work session to Wednesday, and on Wednesday there are some other amendments, as I understand it, that are out there. I would ask if any of you know anyone who has any such amendments, please get them to us really as soon as possible, and we'll get them posted. And I'm willing to hear them on Wednesday, and then we will move on to the next steps on Wednesday. The next step for this legislation is Ways and Means, the Committee on Ways and Means. Hopefully we'll be in a position where we can make that take that vote on Wednesday. Yes, Senator.
Two things. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have amendments in draft. Some of them may address some of these issues, but some of them may address issues that aren't in the dash threes. And I guess my other question would be, are we going to have a fiscal on Wednesday on any of the amendments to be able to move the bill, or?
My hope is that we will. And if not, we won't. of course, this bill goes to Ways and Means, but we would like to have a fiscal actually before we vote to send it down to Ways and Means. It is possible, I think, to have a fiscal light on it, but I think, my hope is that we'll be in a position to have the fiscal. Okay, I want to take the opportunity, since he's here, to thank Charlie again for all his enormous patience, most of it undeserved, and his hard work on this. I think from a technical perspective, I think this is a very good bill. I also personally think the substance is really very important and is going to meet a need and really be a good program for Oregon. So with that, colleagues, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 454. And seeing no other business, we are adjourned.